You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated...
It is Wednesday, May 29th, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Bhaskar Sunkara, founder of the Jacobin, on his letter to the nation from a young radical. Also on the program today, sequestration still lapping up against our shores of any type of economic rally. It's going to get worse, folks. Also on the program today, Jeremy Hammond with a plea deal. Oh, I should also say, apparently we won't have Michelle Bachmann to kick around anymore. In a epic, is it 45-minute video? I don't know. We will play it, well, not the entire thing. Later in the program, Ron Paul, of course, losing to the UN again. Those blue helmets. Thomas Friedman with the solution for the, well, I guess, to our joblessness, at least for really, really elite graduates from elite schools, as long as they use his daughter's friend's company. More on that as the show continues. I want to get to Bhaskar in just a moment, but first, I teased this yesterday. We didn't get to it. I want to get to it today. Also, later in the program, I will give my daughter's reaction to my relating to her that yesterday one of our callers said they felt bad for my children to have such an idiot as a father. I got my daughter's response. You will be shocked by it. Later in the program, of course, we'll take your phone calls later in the hour at 646-257-3920. Maybe not a big surprise to people, but the United States lags all other rich countries in the world for guaranteed paid vacation or holidays. The United States is the only advanced economy, from the Center for Economic and Policy Research, aside from Michael, of course.
I'm a trailblazer.
That's right.
For humane in terms of getting policies, United States.
Enormous amounts of paid vacation. The United States is the only advanced economy in the world that does not guarantee its workers paid vacation. European countries establish legal rights to at least 20 days of paid vacation per year.
Goddamn right.
With legal requirements of 25 and even 30 or more days in some countries. Australia and New Zealand both require employees to grant at least 20 vacation days per year. That explains Michael's sort of tinge of Australian accent. Canada and Japan mandate at least 10 days paid days off. The gap between paid time off in the United States and the rest of the world is even larger if we include legally mandated paid holidays, where the United States offers none. But most of the rest of the world's rich countries offer at least 6 paid holidays per year. So there you have it, folks. The Greeks, despite the fact that they're going through horrible austerity. 4 weeks off plus 6 paid holidays. French, 30 days paid vacation in one holiday. The Germans, 20 vacation days plus 10 holidays, as much as the French, ladies and gentlemen. You'll be happy to know that most workers in the United States do get paid vacation, Michael. About three quarters overall, but there's a huge schism. Paid vacations are nearly universal for higher paid workers, but only half of lower paid hourly wage workers receive paid time off. So there you have it. Hope you enjoyed. If you had Monday off, I hope you enjoyed it. It's rare, unless your name is Michael and you work at the Majority Report.
Me and Goldman execs.
That's right.
We get good vacations.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back in just a moment.
Should I go? If you say that you are mine, I'll be here till the end of time. So you've got to let me know. Should I stay or should I go? It's always tease, tease, tease. You're happy when I'm on my knees. One day is fine, the next is black. So if you want me off your back, well, come on and let me know. Should I stay or should I go? Should I stay or should I go now? Should I stay or should I go now? If I go, there will be trouble. Decisions bugging me.
Decision may molest her.
If you don't want me, set me free.
Set me, yes,
exactly whom I'm supposed to be.
Yeah.
Don't you know which clothes even fit me? Come on and let me know. Should I cool it or should I blow?
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. Bhaskar Sunkara. He is the founder of the Jacobin magazine, also a contributor to In These Times, and has written a piece in the Nation magazine, Letter to the Nation from a Young Radical. Full disclosure, I am a subscriber to the Jacobin. Welcome to the program, Bhaskar.
Really glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
So, all right, let's start with why you decided to write this piece in The Nation.
Why did I decide to pick The Nation as a venue? Or
sure, exactly.
Right. So, So I hope this is coming through all right. The line might be breaking up a bit. But basically, I think that that with an intervention like this, I was really trying to reach a broader and more more liberal audience. And I think the nation's audience is in particular a little bit better than publications like Mother Jones and other publications like that, because a lot of their core audience, I think, are really just, in general, earnest social democrats. You know, they knew instinctively to be against the Iraq War. They have a very good reputation as far as being against American wars and interventions. And even on, like, you know, issues like the intervention in Kosovo, where elements of the American left were really split and divided, I think the nation came down the right side of those lines. But over the last few years, I think what was initially what I guess Victor Novasky called the debating ground between liberals and radicals, I think has started to veer a little bit more into the liberal direction and didn't quite have this contested debating ground. So I just very directly asked Katrina Van Neuvel, the editor of The Nation, you know, whether she'd be interested in something, and she, you know, was. And, you know, to their credit, you know, during the whole editing process, when I was, writing this piece, they wanted the criticisms to be, you know, even more direct. And we ended up, you know, with the piece that, you know, I wanted to write. And I think it made a bit of a stir in a good way. I think people generally appreciated getting something that was, straightforwardly socialist and radical in a way without having to use euphemisms or whatever. And I think that's extremely important thing for this era, because I think we're used to, as radicals and members of the American left, speaking in euphemisms and doing our politics behind the veil of front groups. And it's good to be, direct about it.
Well, what do you mean by that? I mean, I want to get to sort of the distinctions between liberals and the left or radicals. But what do you mean by that, that in general you feel that radicals have spoken in euphemism?
Right. Well, I think that maybe after the fall of the Berlin Wall and just, just the devastation of the left as a whole, because, you know, the left in its two twin, you know, heads, social democracy and I guess those who tied themselves to official communism in a way. I myself have always came out of an anti-Stalinist tradition. But, there was just really the sense that the welfare state was under attack by neoliberalism. We're living in an era where there was no alternative. You know, even the people who still had, you know, some hope that the Soviet Union, you know, it wasn't a great society, but at least it was something different. You know, those people, you know, they were also dejected. I mean, the whole, you know, scene left of liberalism was really just in a state where I guess people felt that it was more useful to, people questioned what use there was in even, you know, labeling yourself a socialist when there wasn't even a social democracy or a reformist left to compare yourself to. So, I think we're living in a lot of ways in the era after the left, you know, after the decay of the left. And we're trying right now as American radicals to try to rebuild what was lost and then see, you know, where we can take it from there.
Help us here with the distinctions. I mean, how do you where do you perceive the difference between liberals and the left or liberals and radicals?
Right. Well, I mean, as I mentioned in the piece, the term liberalism is really kind of slippery and somewhat of a floating signifier. But what I mean by American liberalism, I'm basically referring to people that, you know, if they were in Europe, they would call themselves social democrats. You know, therefore, the expansion of the welfare state, therefore decommodification, like taking out of the market very, key elements of life, like our health care, our elderly care, education, you know, key components. And I think that's like a very, very significant advance in many ways. What I mean by the left, I mean, the distinction I would draw is that the left has a stronger and more structural critique of capitalism as a whole. So in a way, a good way to think about it would be people who are basically social democrats are trying to find bits and pieces of socialism within capitalism to make capitalism better. People on the socialist left, like myself, think that those reforms are a good thing, but we would like to see those reforms used as a stepping stone to more radical transformations. So in other words, worker ownership of their, our factories and our workplaces, the radical extension of political democracy, the growth of new participatory forms of democracy. So in a sense, we want socialism after capitalism, not just within it.
And so you break down, you essentially say that, literally say, American liberalism is practically ineffective and analytically inadequate. And then you call for a jolt from its left as a prerequisite for its resurgence. So why is it at this time, is it practically ineffective and analytically inadequate? Is
right.
this something that's systemic? Is it something that is problematic with liberals' answers to what is more of a systemic problem than one that is, I guess, open to reform?
Right. Well, in the piece, I describe it as more of a systemic problem. And I think that a good way to think about liberalism might be to, think back to seventh grade biology class and think of it as a permeable membrane of some type. And at certain moments, maybe the liberalism of the New Deal, the liberalism of the 1960s, these were moments when liberalism moved to the left and embraced many critiques that one would normally associate with radicalism. And there was other moments, of course, when liberalism, were fellow travelers with war and with, cuts to the very welfare state that the New Deal coalition set into motion. If you look at the, the cheerleading, really, among segments of the liberal coalition for even something like Bill Clinton's welfare reform and things like that, you would see some of the darker moments of liberalism. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's rooted partially in the fact that I historicize it a bit, and I say that at its core, a lot of these liberal notions and liberal ideals, the liberal style, if you will, is rooted in a 18th century Enlightenment fantasy of the Republic of Letters. And that basically paints politics as a salon discussion between polite people with competing ideas. So there's this fantasy that when ideas are argued by wise and well-intentioned people, the best one are assumed to prevail in the end. And I think that the Marxist critique has normally been more, have accounted a bit more for the way interests and passions and power really mark our lives.
Or politics, by another term, I guess, in some respects. So you define or you break down American liberalism into two camps: welfare liberals and technocratic liberals. Tell us, reiterate that distinction for us.
Right. So essentially, my argument is that welfare liberals have been remain basically committed to the New Deal paradigm, and I basically define that as searching for equality of opportunity. They believe in collective bargaining rights. They believe in expanded social safety net. They call for higher tax rates. They want to restore union density. They oppose austerity. They knew instinctively, in other words, when the Chicago teacher strike was raring last fall, which side they were on. These are very quick, answers they come up with when there's struggles like that. And on the other hand, there's this and I basically identify these people as a big core of the Democratic constituency. I'm sure many of your listeners, many of the readers of The Nation. And I say there's a huge disconnect between these people and the people who have basically been entrusted to be the ideas people of the center-left, the progressive coalition, your Ezra Klein's of the world. And I think that among technocratic liberals, these Democratic Leadership Council types and other types are very keen to discard huge elements of this old New Deal coalition for the sake of being competitive. So it's not necessarily a matter of them just being really theoretically bankrupt, but with the real structural changes in the economy, deindustrialization, globalization, the global impasse that social democracy as a whole and in America, American liberalism, the welfare state as a whole had in the 1970s, you saw, in a sense, a crisis of agency where people on the center left were wondering what coalitions are going to keep us in power. And in pursuit of, I guess, votes from middle-class stratas and other areas, these center-left leaders and thinkers have more or less abandoned everything that made them, I guess, liberals to begin with. And I think that the huge divide and disconnect between the technocratic liberals, a lot of the people are the ideas people of this movement, and the base that they rely on to actually enact policy is a divide that the left can exploit. And maybe exploit's the wrong word to use there, but I guess can take advantage of and build new coalitions. And I sort of point to different emerging alliances that saw that at play, whether it be liberal support for the Occupy movement, the broad community support for the Chicago Teachers Union strike, which was actually, pitted the union against a pro-corporate member of the Democratic Party in Rahm Emanuel. So I think there's plenty of other examples of this, but essentially this would mean the reconstitution of some kind of broad liberal left movement, and also at its core, class politics, and that would mean a lot in the American context.
I mean, in many respects, that the relationship with between some of us and President Obama is indicative of that split. I mean, he's as theoretically as technocratic and centrist, I think, as maybe not more so than Bill Clinton, maybe more so in some respects. But that, I think that illustrates the divide that you're talking about.
Right. Yes, I think that that the blanket support that Obama, the undeserved support, I think that he's gotten from the liberal constituencies, is really symptomatic of this divide that doesn't make any sense. It's like, I hate to use a graphic example, but it's basically just like being abused by someone and constantly being thrown as staying with them. I mean, I think the example of Obama is really unfortunate, because it's not just that the left, the American liberals are choosing to stay in his camp begrudgingly, but a huge segments of these publications and other thinkers among American liberals aren't even launching critiques of him. So it's not just a matter of tactically choosing to stay in a coalition, but it's allowing things to go on without really robust critiques. So you have Ron Paul making the most brave and in a way stance against drones and these other policies of Obama. And this task really should have been taken up by American liberals.
Yeah, I mean, I think, I don't know if I would agree with the characterization of Paul, but it is, he certainly filled a void, a vacuum that should have been filled by people on the left, with no
right.
doubt.
Yeah, in Paul's case, it was completely opportunistic, and I think he's in many ways more despicable than the other members of his party. But it was sad that media attention,
yes,
and that critique wasn't made by someone else, and I think it could have easily been.
What do you think? I mean, I have a tough time wrapping my head around this, because I think many of my critiques, both of the sort of the way that you've delineated welfare state liberals and technocratic liberals, are certainly things that I have echoed, but at the same time, what do you think? Let me ask you, what do you think gave rise to that technocratic liberal? I mean, what was it, simply because this seemed to have happened, in one stance? I think the Democratic Party, for lack of a better vehicle, has been the vehicle of liberalism in this country, and it began to untether itself from labor, I think, as early as the early 70s in many respects.
Right. I would actually date a little bit after that. I would say that the that it really happened in the first Carter, the only Carter administration. I think that part of it was rooted at the level of economics. There was a structural crisis of the 70s, economic crisis, that undid a lot of the American welfare state and helped inaugurate neoliberalism. And essentially, neoliberalism's success was a political success. The crisis that existed then was forced upon the working class and the middle class, and profitability rates for the wealthy were restored while the rest of us have been stuck with stagnating real wages. But I think that divide really occurred around then, and at that point, you know, I would argue that the aspirations of these liberal policy types and the aspirations of the voting blocks that these types rely on are really, really just politically striking. So, you know, there's corollaries elsewhere in the world. Third way politics in Britain, people like Tony Blair and Gordon Brown. And the reason why perhaps that the Democratic Party moved further to the right than some of these European parties moved further to the right was that it was pitched at further to the right to begin with. You know, our furthest left in this country was social liberalism, not social democracy. Our welfare state was always more fragmented and less universal than what they had in Europe and, elsewhere in the advanced capitalist world. So we're just in a slightly worse situation now. And I think that maybe now that neoliberalism has really been shown to be bankrupt and everyone's out of ideas and everyone's having the same problem as far as political agency. If you look at the right in this country and the divides that are emerging in the Republican Party over immigration and other key issues, it really just shows everyone wondering about these same things. So the Republican Party is wondering about demographics and about the fact that the trends look horrible and their political prospects at the national level don't look that good, even though because of the way our system is stacked, giving disproportionate weight to certain states. They might continue to be contenders in the House and the Senate. At the presidential level, it's not looking great for them. So there's really a crisis in their party, and it's about political agency. It's about who's going to vote for us and push through our agenda. And on the left, we're dealing with the same problem. Anyone could say, this is what we should do. Anyone could write a program. So to some respect, what I did in The Nation was pretty easy, right? These are the things that we want. Here are some broad coalitions that could make it happen. But the actual details about how, the actual details about the alliances and these sorts of stuff, this is really just a crisis that's affecting everyone. So the center can't hold. Obama's coalition can't really hold. The right can't really push through its agenda. And there's not yet things emerging on the left. So we're really just at an impasse. Politically in this country.
So let's get to that. I mean, in terms of, what the prescription is. I mean, to the question being, I mean, because, many of the critiques, at least in the context of this piece that you wrote in The Nation, and it obviously, there were parameters here in terms of what you were trying to achieve, but many of the critiques are critiques that, more or less, or for the sake of argument, a self-identified liberal has been making within liberalism for quite some time. I mean, where do we go from here? I mean, what does the radical left bring to the table, short of a ballast, if you will, on the left?
Right. Well, I think that there's for good reason that, if we look at Germany, right, we look at the Left Party. The Left Party is a coalition party between disgruntled social democrats who thought that the German Social Democratic Party, which hasn't even moved as far right as the Democratic Party in the United States, had betrayed its historical mission, and trade unionists and other people who have been disillusioned with that party. And also old communist and Trotskyist and other radical left forces in Germany. And they form, you know, the left party. And I think in this kind of way, there are definitely broad swaths of agreement between social democrats and you know, myself, I'm a self-identified democratic socialist, especially when it comes to what we need to do today and what we need to do in the short term. So when I say that, you know, we need a new economic bill of rights of some sort in the short term, when I say that we need to defend Social Security, when I say we need universal child care and we need universal health care, you know, a real single-payer system, and we need to defend other important social goods that we already have on the books. Now, these are things that I would imagine lots of American liberals would agree with, and that's in good measure. Now, I think that the left has to offer basically a deeper understanding of the structures of capitalism and why these reforms have been so hard to enact and also sustain once they have been enacted. In some ways, there's this old Marxist critique of I guess you could apply this to the reformist liberals too. It was initially written in a different context. But basically the myth of Sisyphus and having to roll the boulder up the hill every day only to have it periodically fall back upon him. To some extent, that's been the history of efforts to reform capitalism from within, because you're creating a different balance of forces more in favor of the working class and other communities, but you're doing so in a way that structurally still leaves the levers of power in the control of capitalists. So I think eventually the liberal aspirations for a dramatically transformed society, a society that more drastically and permanently expropriates some and powers workers and other people. It's one that that I think is a big differentiation between radicalism and liberalism. But essentially, even if you want more modest aspirations, these are, I guess, to use the cliche, bridges that will cross when we come to them. And I think that if you look at successful efforts to reform capitalism in Europe and elsewhere, if you look at Sweden, which welfare state reached its peak in the 70s and 80s. These were coalitions that were really built between social democrats and radicals to their left. They weren't coalitions built between people just, one degree to the left of center and their friends who are centrist technocrats. The American coalition, it constantly compromises and fails at every turn because too few of the people actually involved actually want substantial change, and it's not enough to actually pressure and coerce capitalists and the people in power. So sometimes, I think there's merits in more radical demands and associating yourselves with more radical forces. It obviously just depends on who. Like, I'm a member of the Democratic Socialists of America in addition to my other work. I'm more or less just a paper member. But if you look at the orientation of people like Michael Harrington, or the people currently involved with organizations like Cornel West and Franz Fox Piven, I think you'd find that American democratic socialism is quite sophisticated and also has a complex understanding of liberalism and the way forward, which isn't just we need revolution tomorrow. Obviously we want radical change, but at a certain level we need to be operating in the world as it exists and trying to push our program and push our goals from the standpoint of reality itself.
So are those two agendas, the short term and the long term, are they at odds with each other? In other words, if one engages in, and I know that you've written in the Jacobin that socialists and radicals need to sort of to be aware of their context. You used a guy masturbating on the C train as a metaphor, but are those two agendas? I mean, can you hold those simultaneously, and how do you go about doing that? In other words, if you're participating in the process as it stands now, in the world as it is now, are you undercutting your ability to implement more radical change?
Right. Well, I think that that today very few people in America are obviously, and this is going to come as no surprise to any of your listeners, are self-identified socialists. But I think that the core of any future relevant socialist movement would be from people who are essentially self-identified liberals, who are unpoliticized, who are just in college and just getting attracted to ideas, who will get politicized through, you know, basic struggles, through like a union struggle, through any of these community-wide struggles, through outbursts like Occupy and other groups. So I think to some extent on the future left of center are people who just don't quite have completely formed politics yet. So I'm sure that there'll be plenty of people who will principally reject socialism or principally reject even, liberal reform efforts from a basis of knowledge and experience. But right now these movements don't really exist. And even as intellectual and cultural currents, they're very small and marginalized. So I think that there are underlying tensions between the liberal worldview and a more radical worldview. I think there's underlying tensions in the ultimate goals and ambitions. But I think these tensions are something that will kind of resolve themselves over time. And at the very least, we're far away from that point. And I guess those are good contradictions, good tensions to have. You know, I only wish, for example, that we would deal with some of the debates that they're having in the Greek left, for instance. Because between social democrats and radicals in Greece, there's questions of what do we do once we're in power? What do we do once we're voted into office? Because Syriza is consistently polling as the main opposition party in Greece and has come very close to forming a government. And wouldn't those be nice contradictions to have in a generation or two on the American left too?
Right, right. I mean, I agree with that, but I guess on some level, how does one reach those people in the context of, I mean, to use the Sisyphus metaphor here, if that hill seems to be not just systemic to our politics, but almost in some respects cultural. What is it that exists today? Whereas, you know, where if I was living here in the 1920s, I would say that there's been almost imported or immigrated historical awareness and perspective of class. Economic class distinctions, and there would be. I would have come from a tradition where I was at least exposed, if not part of these ideas. But it seems all but gone in this country. I mean, to get Americans to perceive economic class is a tough road to hoe, I guess. I mean, how does that happen?
Right. No, that's definitely true, and that's one of the problems of our predecessors on the American left. They weren't able to keep alive the institutions and the traditions of class struggle or even class identification. And to some extent, in America, we forget about how much class struggle we did have, and not just in the waves of immigrants, like it was completely imported, but also just domestic or organic class struggle among people who had been settled here for many generations. Our industrial battles in the 19th century between workers and capitalists were more bloody and pitched than anywhere else in the world, in the advanced capitalist world, as far as the human costs of them. And that's somewhat easy to obscure because the language was always different. So the European workers might you have used what we as leftists would consider more sophisticated language, more classically socialist language to express our class struggle. While in America we use the language of homestead capitalism, we use Republican language to express what was essentially the same thing, which was the demand to get redress from your employers. So, to some extent, what employers want is exactly the opposite of what workers want. And this isn't because they're bad people. And our capitalists aren't actually, perhaps, I don't know, it's sometimes hard to tell, but they aren't worse people than capitalists in Sweden. Essentially, they want to pay us less, to work us more, and to, pay less to upkeep the conditions in which we work, so they become more dangerous. And we want the exact opposite. And the result, what we end up as a compromise mediated by the state, is just these two poles fighting against each other. And in the last 30, 40 years, we've seen everything tilt very, very much in favor of the capitalists, and we've seen our wages decline and stagnate, and we try to make up the difference in debt, which caused, all sorts of other problems. But, essentially, I think that a lot of this basic class consciousness, a lot of this understanding of our position in the economy and who our real enemies are, like, they're not immigrants, they're not other members of the working class, they're capitalists. I think a lot of this can be regained just through struggles against austerity and also through struggles in the workplace and other fights like that. So I think a lot of it just has to be regained through struggle and also just through organization and mass education. But yeah, it's a very difficult task. But part of understanding the difficulty of the task would be to think about what our goals are in the next 5 to 10 years. And my goal as an American socialist in the next decade or so is organizational regroupment of people who already identify as socialists and are already a part of politically compatible organizations. I think it'd be important to put us all under the same tent. And I also think participating in largely defensive anti-austerity struggles and also trying to push for things like the Occupy student debt movement, I think, is a very, very progressive, important struggle. And there's plenty of other local struggles. But I think what the left needs to understand is that a lot of this will require a strategy of patience. And patience means, and patience in the strategic sense, not patience as in we should just sit back and relax. We obviously need to really get working, participating in these struggles, and also keep our own house in order and doing plenty of other things. But patience as in, we're not going to storm the barricades tomorrow over the whole system. We're not going to transform everything overnight. But we can start to rebuild some of that institutional legacy that's been lost, some of that cultural legacy that's been lost. And, that's just a long, long process. And we have a generation or two worth of work to make up for, because we've lost a generation in between the new left and this now emerging next left. We had plenty of old radicals and plenty of young radicals at all these events, plenty of really active good people between 20 and 30, plenty of active good people over 60. The question is, what happened to all these people in the intervening decades? And those decades were lost years, and we're going to need to have to recover that and make sure that doesn't happen again.
That's my generation. Sorry.
Right.
Sorry about that. So if I hear you, the idea is for the left to essentially struggle against, let's say, austerity, used as an example, and that struggle is one that is shared by the welfare liberals, and simultaneously to build some type of a broader umbrella to both solidify those who identify or have a politics that's informed by the class structure, and then down the road to expand that and to sort of, I guess, expand the knowledge and the perspective that those have, that those on the left have about those structures.
Right. How to engage, and also at an intellectual level, I guess this is the same two-front battle that I'm fighting in my Nation piece. How to engage with liberals and write in, you know, the flagship liberal venue without becoming a liberal yourself, right?
Right. So, well, that's what I'm saying.
Same thing.
Right. I mean, how does that happen? I mean, because you're fighting against austerity, I guess maybe one level down in the sort of, you know, you're out there holding the signs. Next to you stands a welfare liberal holding the same anti-austerity sign. But when you put the signs down and go to the bar, then you're explaining that the perspective on why you're at that protest is different.
Right. Well, I think that what groups require in order to engage in really useful mass work like that, without watering down your critique, is an actual intelligent ideological core. Like, you need to actually know your stuff, know what you're about, know your history, know your tradition, know what you want in order to do that tactically. And also, to some extent, socialists can't think about trying to immediately build their particular little organization, recruit every single person they bring into this tent. Like, we don't want to create, you know, front groups in the sense that, you know, you as a liberal or someone as a liberal, you know, walks into a meeting because they're against the death penalty and ends up, you know, essentially being a front for a larger socialist organization. You know, we need to engage openly and in good faith. You know, we're socialists. This is what we stand for. Listen, it's not that scary. We want many of the same things you want. Here's where we differ. And just engage in that dialogue in good faith. And I think that's how you build alliances and you build coalitions. You don't merely try to extract from wherever there's vibrancy and activity and, you know, parasitically, right? It should be a symbiotic relationship. And to the other extent, I think that it's really important for liberals to understand the ways in which the left has traditionally been left out to dry and red-baited and attacked by people who were at once their allies. You know, the Popular Front is a somewhat problematic example because of how virulent and nasty a lot of these Stalinist groups were, or the Communist Party was. But if you look at the way that, you know, liberals turned on their former allies after World War II when it came to just the way the Wallace campaign in 48 was villainized, and the way in which, you know, Taft-Hartley really attacked the core of the American labor movement under the pretenses of anti-communism and with red-baiting, you know, ideology. You know, you look at the same thing happening during World War One and the great disaster, you know, inflicted upon the Socialist Party of America. And if you want to know why there's very little institutional left in the country, you know, that's a place to look, those years between 1917 and 1920. So, yeah, it really just, it's a difficult thing, but this is how the left has been built in America before, and I think that this is how the left in America, you know, this is one way that I can conceive of it being built. And I see very other, you know, feasible alternatives from my perspective. So it's still a long shot and difficult battle, but I'm not sure if there's a bad strategic orientation for the left. I'm not responsible for obviously the way the cards were dealt.
Right.
Just trying to play the hand.
And when you talk about that idea of, you know, bringing people and use the analogy of the example of fighting the death penalty, for instance. I mean, it what occurs to me are the anti-war protests that took place against the Iraq War. And in many respects, there was, I think was it answer or, and I think there was sort of a, there were times where it was not so much of a problem for me, but I know that people who were going out to those anti-war protests would sometimes get turned off by the fact that it ended up being sort of more a statement, a broader statement of of anti-capitalism or whatnot. And I think that was, in your example, that is, that doesn't work. Is that what you're saying?
I mean, right. I mean, I think that doesn't work. And just as a at a very bourgeois ethical perspective, it's also kind of unethical to just basically use people as fodder for your own kind of mission. Right. I guess it's a get rich quick scheme for the left to build these front routes, and get rich quick schemes never work. So that's what I mean when I think it requires honest, broad coalition work and patient coalition work, and not these front groups. And these are kind of fine distinctions. I'm not sure how they're coming across to your listeners, because I think your example is a very good one. You kind of have to see it to know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
And the anti-war movement is a good example. And I think there were times when I myself, well, when I was just in high school and still more or less identified as a liberal, was in a an answer coalition, for example, protest. And a protest that I broadly agreed with the ends, but I didn't quite agree with the the chants or the way that it was quite billed by its organizers, and that was somewhat of an alienating experience. And perhaps that's not the best face for the left to put on for the broader world. But at the same time, how does one say to people marching beside them that, you know, you're marching against this war, but you should be marching against war, and here are the structures that produce war. And if you don't want to keep marching or have your children marching in the same march that you're marching in, or your children's children, then we need to structurally change things. And that's a fine balance, to be able to make those articulations in a way that actually challenges the preconceptions of the people you're engaging with, without quite doing it in a abrasive or dishonest way.
And so does this theory of change that you're talking about, where where does it end? In other words, for the next 10 years, let's say, I mean, I'm putting, just for the lack of better sort of parameters here, but for the next 10 years, does that mean that you weigh in on the in a Democratic primary for the more progressive of two candidates? Does that go as far as we're going to vote for Obama over Romney? Where is that line?
Right.
I mean, in practice?
Well, those are tactical questions, right? And there are questions that the left, even people who broadly agree with me on the left, which I would say is a good portion of the organized socialist left, really disagree on.
Right.
And a group like my own personal stance is, when it comes to these divisive national electoral questions, we don't have enough power to really make a decisive impact in the race. So it makes no sense for an organization, I think, like DSA or Freedom Road or any of these other socialist organizations to make what could be potentially divisive statements in saying, oh, we endorse Obama or we don't endorse Obama. It's kind of play acting, like you actually have the strength and power like the Socialist Party of America had in the teens or even 20s, when it could actually, play a key role in the way that, certain states would swing. But I personally think, for example, that when it comes to primaries, I'm not opposed to running more progressive candidates in Democratic primaries. And I'm also not opposed to supporting a fusion slate like the Working Families Party in New York. But I'm also not opposed to supporting a green candidate when that candidate is better than the Democrat on the slate, or when that could help build a broader movement. So I think the real question for the left comes up to, do you support a candidate like Nader in 2000 or whatnot? And on that end, I think that the traditional strategy pursued by the left, or this kind of left, has been the inside-outside strategy, which is in some ways obsolete because it was built to a different era. The broad tenets might still be correct, but it means something very different to be inside outside the Democratic Party now than it did in the 1970s. So the primary orientation, I think, should be to mass movement work and doing other things outside the sphere of electoral politics, not because electoral politics are icky and, you know, we should morally condemn it and avoid it, but because we're at the point where the left in most areas can't actually be a significant force to actually make these interventions usefully. Now, in a place like New York, I think New York City is ripe for a left liberal slate, you know, independent political action, as the Trotskyists used to call it. And right here, I think that there's easily city council seats that could be grabbed by something to the left. The political paradigm in New York City could definitely be shaken up in the next 5-10 years. I'm not quite sure if that's universally applicable, but that's, you know, basically tactics, not necessarily a strategic orientation.
Right. I mean, but that is, but it's strategic in the sense that you're going to pursue that from, I mean, that is, it's strategic at least in the sense that where you're going long term, right? I mean, because that's part of, you're going to have to build that coalition with those welfare liberals, and that's where they are, essentially.
Right. And you can't change these things by an act of will alone. You know, you can't change the fact that, I mean, my parents are immigrants, like lower middle class background, and we've been in the Democratic Party, or they've been in the Democratic Party, or identified it since they got off the boat in the late 80s. And that makes sense from a practical standpoint, because not only do they think that Bill Clinton was charismatic, and that part is maybe just pure ideology, doesn't make much sense, but they realize that they represented their interests more as immigrants and as, you know, given their position in the economy, than the other guys did. And you have to at least have sympathy and understanding to why these people are voting in these blocks, and you know, move from there and move intelligently, but with understanding and sympathy and with the knowledge that it's not easy for certain people just to say, you know, don't vote or vote third party or, like, you know, whatever, because these are hard-run, you know, struggles.
Right.
Even the way that first-generation immigrants and immigrants who've been naturalized vote, you know, even getting citizenship, exercising that right to vote, is a hard-won struggle. And to for them in a two-party system to tell them to vote third party immediately really, I think, downplays the complexities and the struggle that goes into that decision to, you know, cast your first ballot.
So, I mean, ultimately, and pardon the reduction here, but it's like Betty Draper said that in Mad Men, when she was waiting to divorce her husband, she's just got to basically wait until she has a little more power to make the big move. I hate to do that, but it's better than using a Happy Days reference.
Right. I'll forgive you.
Thank you. All right. So, all right. Well, it's fascinating stuff. And I want to just encourage people to head over and get a subscription to the Jacobin. It's a great magazine. I haven't read this issue, but I have it in my bag. And so I appreciate the time. Bhaskar Sunkara, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me, and thanks for the support, for subscribing.
My pleasure. All right, folks, we went a little bit. We didn't go too late, did we? Because we did two songs in there. All right, we went a little bit late. Yes, sorry about that. It's interesting stuff, because I think tomorrow on the program, we're going to be playing an interview I did with Gar Alperowitz that I interviewed him last week, and he is coming from a similar perspective of perceiving that systemically there is a problem that liberal reform cannot address. And his perspective, prescription is different insofar as he's talking less about politics and more about simply Well, maybe in some respects they're similar, but he is talking about that in many respects, alternative systems have already been developed in this country and are pre-existing, and we just need to have a greater awareness of it. So in many respects, we're seeing this this movement on the left, long-term project, and apparently my generation screwed up everything.
Definitely. That seems to be a common theme.
Well,
from
the
left through the liberals.
I am going to my 25th year reunion this weekend, and I am going to give them crap about it. I guaranteed. Guaranteed.
I'm going to Khan College, and I'm going to redeem Generation X.
And at one point, I will talk about the my nemesis, who I think is a Republican. Yeah, nemesis, strong word, but. All right, folks.
Arch nemesis?
arch nemesis would definitely be going too far.
Frenemy?
Frenemy, I don't know if we...
Frenemy is lame to even say. Get out of here right now.
I don't even know what that means. Folks, it's your support that makes this show possible. Please, if you have the financial means, I know I say this every day, and I know you probably think, like, yeah, Sam, they don't need it. They don't need it for the show. Yeah, we do. So if you can become a member, please do at majority.fm. You can buy your Amazon crap. If you buy it from Amazon, buy it through our link. It's now on the homepage. Just scroll down to the bottom, click that link, bookmark it, buy all your Amazon crap through there, and we get a little kickback. See you tomorrow, or stick around for the better half of the program, 646-257-3920. Say to the blue.